It's a very special privilege for the Miller Center to welcome Edmund Muskie, former Secretary of State, United States Senator, and Democratic candidate for Vice President in 1968. That he has not been at the Miller Center before is merely a function of his own heavy obligations. We've wanted him to visit virtually from the founding of the center, because so much of his thinking represents a parallel attack on some of the great issues of the presidency that's going on at this place. He was born in Rumford, Maine. He received his bachelor's degree from Bates College and his law degree from Cornell. He's received, I believe, something in the neighborhood of 20 honorary degrees from institutions such as William and Mary, Bowdoin, Boston, Notre Dame, and other institutions. He practiced law in Maine, was elected to the Maine House of Representatives, served from 1948 to 1951 in that capacity, and was Democratic floor leader. He was governor of Maine from 1955 to 1959. He served as United States Senator from Maine from 1959 to 1980. In that position, he became widely recognized as an acknowledged leader in the Senate. He was Deputy Majority Whip at one point, but also an authority in certain well-defined areas such as energy, environment, arms control, and other areas. The member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee gave that up temporarily to become chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, served as subcommittee chairman of the Senate Governmental Operations Committee, and left the Senate to take the position of Secretary of State at a very crucial stage of the Carter administration. He's received numerous awards, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, former Members of Congress Distinguished Service Award, and other awards. It's a great privilege for those of us who have known Edmund Muskie, even in a limited way, to welcome him to the Miller Center.
Thank you, Kim. That was more than the occasion required. I'm glad to be. I suspect one of the reasons I've not been here before is because of the intimidating reputation of this group. In any case, I understand that really the productive part of such a meeting are the questions, and I am eager to get to the questions. But I also understand the importance of saying a few things at the outset to stimulate the questions and maybe to enable us to adjust to each other so that we can have a free exchange. And I discussed this with Ken in advance and thought perhaps a useful way to serve that purpose would be for me to give you a little anecdotal material on my experience in the State Department and how it happened to come about. I suppose it begins really with my application to law school. I'd forgotten what I said on that application, but I'd been offered a scholarship to Cornell Law School. Had never thought about being a lawyer, and so I asked to have the summer to think about it now. You know, to postpone a decision on something of that kind in the middle of a depression was, you know, sort of a foolish thing to do, but I did. Finally agreed to take it and applied. But in my application, I made it clear that I wasn't sure I wanted to be a lawyer, but that I thought the law school might be a good way to get into the Foreign Service. Well, it took me 50 years. And I'm not sure that my law school education had a damn thing to do with it. In any case, I'd always found executive responsibility more stimulating and interesting than legislating. I enjoyed being governor, enjoyed being Secretary of State, and tolerated being the United States Senator. At the time that Cy Vance resigned from the State Department, which of course is the occasion for my nomination to the State Department, I was traveling. I was in the West. I traveled to Arizona to campaign for Mo Udall, who was running for re-election. And on that occasion, I met Bruce Babbitt for the first time. And then I went to Colorado to campaign for Gary Hart, who was running for his second term. And I was on my way back to Nashville to make a speech to a group interested in water pollution legislation. And on the way back, we landed in St. Louis, drop off passengers, and there was a message for me to call the White House switchboard. But I had no idea what that was about. I hadn't heard of Cy Vance's resignation at all. So I called the White House switchboard from St. Louis, and the switchboard operator didn't know who was calling me. So I got back on the plane, and got off at Nashville, and there again was a message at the airport. And I tried again to get through to the White House switchboard, and again, I struck out. So I went on to my hotel and prepared to deliver my speech that evening, and did. Now, in the meantime, the White House had been in contact with my wife, and she had heard the news. So she immediately concluded, you know, that I would not have been egotistic enough to conclude that what they were looking for me for was to replace Vance. Well, I didn't have access to her either. So I made the speech, got back in the room about 11 o'clock, and the president finally reached me. And he didn't indicate what he was calling me for. I couldn't guess what he was calling me for. So we chatted for a while, and then I thought, well, maybe he wants to go fishing. I invited him to go fishing in northern Maine several times. He loved fly fishing. And so I waited for that. Nothing happened. And finally he said, I suppose you're wondering why I'm calling. I said, yes. He said, well, I'd like you to be my Secretary of State. But that's the first indication I had that there was a vacancy. And it left me speechless, which, you know, a condition I'm not accustomed to. After all, he said, well, what do you say? Well, I said, it has some appeal. I think those were the exact words. He said, well, you see any problems? Well, I said, it occurs to me that I need to talk to my wife, to my accountant, to my political advisors, and to the governor of Maine. Well, how long will that take? I said, well, I'm going back to Washington in the morning, and I will try to get all that done sometime tomorrow. Well, he hung up on that. 6 o'clock the next morning, he was on the phone again. And he said, I'm on my way to Texas, and we could drop down in Nashville and pick you up, and we could talk. I said, I don't need to talk to you. I need to talk to my wife, my governor. So he said, well, when can we talk? Well, I said, when are you going to be back? Well, we agreed then that I would meet him at 5 o'clock. I went back to Washington, had those conversations, and the one problem that I wasn't able to resolve that day was what to do, how I could protect my staff. After all, they'd come with me and expected to be with me during my term, which I still had 2 years to run, and I wanted to be sure that they, that their futures were jeopardized by my making the sudden term. So I met with the president, and first thing I wanted to know was whether I would be his foreign policy spokesman or whether I would be sharing that responsibility with somebody else. Well, he made it quite clear that I would be his foreign policy spokesman. That reassured me. Then I told him about the problem of my staff. I said, I really have to talk to the governor about who he will appoint as my successor and to what extent I can get a commitment from him to urge my successor to protect my staff. Well, the president said, take a White House plane and go up to Maine and see if you can solve the problem, which I did. I called the governor. He happened to be having supper with, we only have supper in Maine, we don't have dinner. And he was having supper with four or five noted journalists in the Maine political scene. And so we had, I couldn't tell him why I was calling, but he guessed. So I met him at the Brunswick Naval Air Station the next morning. We discussed the problem. He already had a list of potential candidates to succeed me. And I told him what I wanted. I said, it's your responsibility to pick my successor. I won't attempt to try to suggest who it ought to be. I'm glad to discuss the candidates if you want. But primarily, I want to pick my staff. He said, I'll take care of that. So we called the president. I said, the light is green, we can go forward. We'll come down here, we've got to have a press conference at 5 o'clock. So we did. The thing I remember about the press conference is that after the president announced my appointment, the press began to throw questions, of course. And the one that I remember is Sam Donaldson, because they were trying to push me on this whole question of the Vance resignation and whether I thought it was justified and, would I do the same thing and all that sort of thing. I did my best to answer the questions. And finally, as I began to walk off the stage, he said, Senator, he said, you've left us a little ambivalent. And I said, well, then it's been a successful press conference. Well, from then on, it was an interesting 8 months. It was 8 months and 20 days, precisely. And the immediate problem, of course, is what to do in the aftermath of the failed rescue attempt of the hostages, and what our policy was going to be, and some immediate chores that I faced. We're meeting in Brussels of the NATO defense secretaries. It seemed an appropriate place for me to launch my career with the NATO allies. And then the Austrian state treaty ceremonies, the 25th anniversary in Vienna, where all of the wartime allies would be gathered, including, of course, Mr. Gromyko. And that offered a challenge because following the invasion of Afghanistan, I don't think there'd been a meeting at the foreign secretary level with Gromyko. So this question of how to deal with that in the light of the Afghanistan situation, we of course had imposed embargoes, the Olympic boycott, and other policies. And so I had to deal with those, and that was almost an immediate challenge. And beyond that was the economic summit scheduled in June. And following that, I made a commitment to visit with the ASEAN country foreign ministers in Southeast Asia. So in the first month and a half, I had a very busy schedule. And of course, I had the problem of adjusting to the State Department and establishing my position there. It was a very different kind of situation than is normal when a new secretary takes office with the president. I ruled out immediately any idea of forming my own team. I felt that in the interest of continuity immediately and coming to grips immediately that I would take the team that Vance had assembled and deal with it. And offer them my confidence and their credibility. And I did that. That was the first step I took. That was well taken, and I had no reason in the next 8 months to have second thoughts about that. I got all of the cooperation I could expect. They were very forthcoming and welcomed, apparently, my willingness to dispose of that problem immediately. I had a problem of persuading Warren Christopher to stay on. He, of course, had hoped that he might be appointed secretary, and I could understand that. He was eminently qualified to be secretary. But I gathered that the president, being an election year, found it useful to have a member of the Senate. The Senate was a problem with the hostage crisis and other issues pending. And also, politically, he needed someone who had a national constituency of sorts. I felt that was his reasoning. And so I was able to persuade Warren Christopher to stay on. And our relationship was perfect, as far as I was concerned, for the rest of that year. He was invaluable in the course of the Iran hostage negotiations. So that team in place, and it really was in place anyway, it's just that I made it clear that it was to continue. Went on to Brussels, went on to the Austrian State Treaty, ceremonies, and that was that was interesting because of the confrontation with Mr. Gromyko, because each of the he and I each made speeches on that occasion. I followed him, and in the course of that one, in commemorating the 25th anniversary of the Austrian State Treaty and the end of the war, so far as that country is concerned, I made reference, a clear and unambiguous reference, to the invasion of Afghanistan, and the press regarded that as a confrontation with Mr. Gromyko. And then at lunch that day, he and I were seated side by side by those thoughtful Austrians. And we had an interesting exchange. I remember his saying to me, well, I had met him before when I was in the Senate. This was my first meeting with him on this occasion, and he said, well, Mr. Secretary, he said, we in Moscow, we are facing this question. Who is Muskie? What is he? We understand that on the one hand, he has a terrible temper, very hard to get along with, but on the other hand, he can compromise. And I said, well, Mr. Minister, I said, I hope that you're always in doubt. At that point, I waved my finger under his nose, and it was that picture that appeared on the front page of the European edition of Newsweek magazine. But we had civil discussions. On that occasion, we met then privately for a couple of hours with just ourselves. And our second meeting was at the opening of the United Nations Assembly in the fall of 1980. And I had the feeling that if I had continued in office, that there was a basis for a constructive relationship, without optimism, but a constructive relationship. We found that we could talk to each other civilly and in disagreement, but that it was possible to explore possibilities. And so I found that encouraging. Coming back to the United States, there was a lot of work to be done in preparing for the summer ahead, the summit in Venice in June was the next big challenge. Our problems with our allies were serious. There was the usual complaint, you know, that there was inadequate consultation on our part with our NATO allies before taking important foreign policy initiatives. The personal relationships between President Carter and Chancellor Schmidt particularly were far from favorable. They simply didn't strike it off well with each other. And fortunately, I got along well with the German foreign minister, Mr. Genscher, who's still there, incidentally. I think he's the longest sitting foreign minister in the free world. And now that Gromyko is gone from both sides of the Iron Curtain, very able man who I gather, as I discussed this yesterday with somebody, apparently he has regained his position of influence that he lost temporarily when his party almost lost a sufficient percentage in the vote to qualify for representation in the Reichstag. So he's back, I think, in full force. So it's good to see some of these people continue. The other ministers who were there when I was there are all gone. Carrington's gone. Colombo of Italy is gone. François Poncet of France is gone. So they're all gone. The changes take place. The Venice summit, as I would think back, was most notable because of the personal explosion between Schmidt and Carter, which is very private, except that I was present and they were present. I think Brzezinski was present. Very unpleasant situation. That summit isn't notable for anything that anyone remembers about what we achieved. And we went on from there to a foreign minister's meeting in Ankara. First, I think, ever held in Ankara. The issues there were the internal instability of the Turkish regime at that point, the violence which resulted in escalating number of deaths attributable to political instability, and shortly after that, the military took over. You remember that at that point, there's even serious concern about the safety of the visiting foreign minister. It was an interesting personal experience for me. It was my first NATO foreign ministers meeting, and it happened to be our country's turn to be the public spokesman at that point, so it was my first opportunity to make an impression publicly and on my associates at the State Department level. The Greek-Turkey dispute's always a problem. That was a problem then. The situation in Cyprus was an ongoing problem. And there were separate meetings with the Greek foreign minister about Greek bases, an issue that still persists in our relations. So there were a lot of old situations of that kind. Then I went on from there to Southeast Asia, stopping in India on the way, and had what I think was a very constructive experience with the ASEAN foreign ministers. I was the only outsider present. We got along very well. The principal issue of concern, there are two at that point, issues that are still of concern, the refugee camps on the Thai border. The Thai government wanted some military assistance to help them control the border to protect the refugees. I was able to arrange for that. And the other issue, of course, was Kampuchea and whether or not the current representation of the United Nations should be ceded, or whether the new government in Kampuchea should be ceded. So that issue, which is a continuing one, and I think we succeeded with the help of some of others in the UN of keeping the old seating there rather than appear to be favoring the Vietnamese and their satellite government in Kampuchea. Came back to this country, and of course on the front burner was the Iranian hostage matter. The presidential election continued with its ups and downs, mostly downs for the president. And Iranian policy, as it emerged, was a very simple one. Number one, decided to use patience as an important instrument, to wait until the Iranians had their government in place. And I think it was in August that the Majlis was finally in place, and they elected a prime minister. And I wrote him a letter, which we hope might begin the process, the slow process of negotiation. You may remember that they wanted us to apologize for having imposed the Shah on Iran. And in my letter, I did not offer an apology, but I indicated that we had mutual grievances against the other, and that we ought to find a way of discussing those, either directly or through third parties. He read that letter, and the Speaker of the House, and that's really what I'm talking about, the Speaker of the House, read that letter to the press without comment, and it was toward the latter part of August or the early part of September that I got a message from Genscher, the German foreign minister, indicating that the Iranians were interested in beginning a dialogue indirectly under German auspices. And it's then that we began the negotiating process. We sent Warren Christopher to Germany, West Germany. Schmidt acted as host. And the slow process of talking, we had to find a way to exchange messages indicating that we were in touch with each other. We wanted to be sure that these talks were going on with the Khomeini's knowledge and approval. And they, of course, wanted to be sure that they were in touch with us and that we were positive and interested in going forward. Our signal was made in my speech to the United Nations Assembly that fall. And the Khomeini himself used his code in this public statement that he made. So we were in contact. And those contacts continued slowly. A lot of things to be ironed out. The Iraq War broke out about that time. I think it was late September. At about the time that we were meeting with the United Nations Assembly, it's traditional for the United States Secretary of State to use the opening of the United Nations Assembly to hold bilateral talks with as many foreign ministers as possible. That's quite an exercise. I think in a period of a week or 10 days, I met with 25 or 30 foreign ministers on a bilateral basis, which involved, of course, extensive briefings from the State Department people on the state of each of these relationships, which, of course, I had not been exposed to as a United States Senator. So that was a real education for me. I appreciate it. So far as the Iraq war is concerned, the Iranian minister came to that assembly looking for support. And I think that was an important event. Because he was told in no uncertain terms, not only by those he consulted in Europe, but those in the unaligned world that he consulted, that if he really wanted to get the sympathetic response from the United Nations with respect to the Iran-Iraq war, that he ought to straighten out the hostage situation. The United Nations, you may remember, voted overwhelmingly in support of us on that issue, and as did the World Court. And so he got that message loud and clear. In the meantime, we had persuaded many of our friends among European nations and elsewhere to make interventions in Iran in behalf of the solution of the hostage crisis. People who regarded themselves as friendly to Iran, the Iranian people, And those interventions continued on almost a daily basis all the time. And this exposure to the United Nations attitude, I think undoubtedly was helpful in persuading the Iranians to begin the talks that ultimately resulted in success. Well, the election, of course, then was the next event, politically at least. To this day, I'm not sure why the Iranians at that point opened up the issue, taking it to the margins of the parliament, and exposing their discussion to the media once again. And I'll never forget that weekend before Election Day when Americans via television relived all over again the agonizing days of the original hostage taking. They were repeated on television, and the Iranians, of course, did. And I sort of feel that the Iranians did this, and they laid down were their terms at that point for the resolution of the hostage, unacceptable in that form to us. But I think they thought they were doing President Carter a favor by doing this. And of course, to the contrary, they completely destroyed his prospects for re-election in that weekend. At the beginning of that weekend, the polls showed Carter and Reagan almost equal, I think. And by the evening before Election Day, he was hopelessly behind. It happened that quickly. Reminded to the American people that the election campaign itself, the Secretary of State traditionally does not get involved in the politics of that period. I did make speeches around the country on foreign policy in order to lay out the president's foreign policy and what we were doing. But he lost. After that, we filled the interregnum with continuing negotiations. The Iranians wanted to shift from the West Germans as the intermediary to the Algerians. The Algerians came in and were superb. They were just it was very difficult. Farsi is a very difficult language to penetrate, not just in terms of speaking it, but in terms of the substance of discussions. So the Algerians were helpful. They did not act as mediators, but they simply carried these messages back and forth and undertook in each case to explain the circumstances in which the new position was taken. All three of the Algerian group were experienced in the negotiations which separated Algeria from France, ultimately. So they had excellent background, they were truly expert. I met with them. Lord Christopher had the primary responsibility for traveling back and forth, as he had to do from time to time. And we had a team, there's an excellent book on this, I don't know if you've got it in your library, Ken, on the negotiations.
I think we
did. Yeah, it was, I think it was published under the auspices of New York Bar. And all of the people in our team contributed to that account, which I think is as accurate as it could be. So if you wanted the details, you can get it there. Warren Christopher was part of that. And there were people from Treasury, of course. The transfer of funds that was involved was enormously complicated. And if it weren't for the development of electronic transfers, it probably could not have been done, because we had to exchange, we had to arrange for the exchange of the hostages and the transfer of the money at the same moment through the National Bank, the national banks in London, in Algeria, and ultimately the Central Bank of Iran. That all had to be done before the hostages would be allowed to move to the Algerian aircraft to fly out of Iran. So it was a touch-and-go situation. It wasn't finally completed until a half hour into the new Reagan administration, as you remember. So it was a touch-and-go situation, and in my period of negotiations, I tell you, it was frustrating, because we had to reassure the Congress that movement was taking place. just about every weekend I was asked to appear on Meet the Press or Issues and Answers, or in which, you know, the media undertook to try to dig out of me as much detail about what was going on as possible. And we had to be very careful about not disclosing those details, because that might well, you know, interrupt an initiative that had some promise of success, that would be destroyed if the Iranians knew that we were talking about it publicly. And of course, all this time, the incoming administration was undertaking to poo-poo these arrangements. They really didn't have a plan themselves, as they disclosed later. But we had to keep we had to keep our cool and a steady hand on things as they were going, tell the American people enough to know that the thing was progressing, without telling them more than we could risk publicly exposing. So it was an interesting game from week to week. I was waiting for Sunday to Sunday when I had to face the American people and cover what was going on, but appear to be disclosing what was going on. Very nice exercise. But it worked. And I remember the toughest one was when a demand made by the Iranian surface, and it looked like a $24 billion ransom demand. I don't know if you remember that. It wasn't that at all, but it would look that way unless you understood what was going on, you know, and what they were really saying. And I think what we finally transferred to them was on the order of $2 or $3 billion that didn't appear to be needed to meet the claims of creditors, Iranian creditors who had attached to these holdings in the United States and elsewhere. But in any case, it worked out, and the principle that we worked on was, if you will undo what you've done with the hostages, in other words, release them, we will undertake to undo what we did in blocking your assets. The difficulty being that courts are involved to the extent that creditors have brought suit and put attachments on these assets. So the tribunal was established for the purpose of presiding over the resolution of all those issues, and that was the principal legal issue, which ultimately had to be decided by the Supreme Court after our administration was decided. The court held the president did have authority to transfer jurisdiction over these claims from our courts to the arbitration tribunal. And with that done, that work continues. It's not yet finished. I think it's nearing completion now, 8 or 9 years after the fact. And then our last act, made possible by President Reagan, was to fly to, what's the place in Germany? Wiesbaden. To meet the hostages. That was our reward for all this effort. A reward we thoroughly appreciated. Well, I think with that, that's enough at this point. You may want to probe and do it, or any other area that you want to talk about. How much of our time have we taken? Oh, we've got time.
Shall we begin at least with discussions on the things that have been said and the Carter presidency generally? If at the very end you have a question or two on the Tower Board, Secretary Muskie has said he might be willing to address that as well. Who'd like to ask the first question? Yes.
Senator, to what extent during the negotiations did you keep the incoming administration advised about the details after the election, before the inauguration? And secondly, is it true, as your successor, Secretary Haig, wrote, that immediately after the negotiation, they had a long discussion as to whether to honor your agreement with Iran or not?
That's two questions.
Two questions.
Yeah. On an ongoing basis, we did not. But we did keep them informed to the extent that they sought information. I mean, when the first meeting, of course, was between Mr. Reagan and President Carter in his office. And from Franklin Carter's description of that meeting, which I hesitate to dig into, President Reagan didn't appear to want a thorough briefing. There were a number of issues to cover, of course, a number of issues, including that one. But to the extent that he wanted a briefing, it was available. Now, with respect to the State Department, it took quite a while before President Reagan selected a Secretary of State. I think it was in December when Haig was finally selected. And one of Haig's first acts was to meet with me. And I undertook the briefing to the extent that he desired briefing. We did not go beyond that. I think it would have been very difficult to go beyond that. On an ongoing basis. It was difficult enough to keep the negotiations going. And we couldn't be sure from day to day, from week to week, whether or not the track that we were currently on would move up. One of the very low visibility issues was whether or not in restoring to the Iranians their assets, we would restore to them military equipment that the Shah had bought and paid for. The new administration, through those people who ventured to speak on the subject, including Mr. Kissinger, who was not a part of the new administration, but you know, was consulted, you know, assumed that we were preparing to do that. Well, we were not. But we didn't want the issue raised publicly. Because if it were raised publicly, you might put an idea in the Iranians' heads that we hoped they were not considering. For their own reasons, they were not considering it. And we simply didn't want to discuss those reasons or to raise the issue in any way that would make it an obstacle. Because it would have been a very serious obstacle if they had asked for that. And if we had truly been committed to the principle of, you know, you restore us and we'll restore you, you know, they could have used that logic against us. But the fact is, it was not raised. We did not indeed restore those military supplies, and they did not ask for them, whether or not they ever considered them. I don't know what's happened to them since. Probably much of it is now obsolete. Whether or not they should be reimbursed is an issue that I suspect will be raised at some point. Whether they should be reimbursed the current value of obsolete equipment, or reimbursed the value that they gave for it, interesting question. We couldn't solve all the questions. Now, with respect to the time that the administration gave to deliberating upon whether or not to accept the agreement, I really have no position to answer that question. I don't know. But I know that shortly after the new administration took office, we were asked to testify on Capitol Hill on these agreements. And at that point, they seemed to have made up their mind. There was no question about it. I can't remember who it was who said specifically. They were glad the problem had been dealt with because they had no plans for dealing with it. And so I think they really were appreciative of the fact that the subject was ended. So the president was in the position of taking credit for welcoming these hostages back home in those glorious ceremonies at the White House, and without having to worry about how to get it done. And of course, since that time, he's had other educational experiences on the problems of dealing with hostages.
There's a well-publicized dispute between Vance and Brzezinski. I'll ask a question about your relations with Brzezinski. In his book, he suggests that you were not well informed on foreign affairs, very heavily dependent upon Warren Christopher, more discursive than Vance, but less contentious. He found it easier to reach decisions with you at State.
I find that amazing.
This is from his book. Were there substantial policy disputes between Brzezinski and you, and were there any problems created by the institutional structure of MSC?
Well, there were annoyances with respect to your description of what he said in the book. Of course, I was not as informed of foreign policy matters as someone who had spent his life in that area. As a senator, I had been involved, of course, to the extent that senators are as one of the institutions of government that share foreign policy responsibility, referred to that extent. I've been a member of the Foreign Policy Committee. I've taken trips abroad at the request of the President. I had spent 2 weeks in Brussels, in West Germany, in Poland, in Portugal, and in Spain at the request of the President. And I had led a congressional delegation to mainland China a week before normalization, a month before normalization. And I gathered from what I learned later, after I've been Secretary of State, that a report of my performance of those assignments, in important part, led to his asking me to be Secretary of State. So I've been exposed to foreign policy, but to pretend that I was an expert, no, I was not. And I certainly wouldn't suggest that I could compete with Brzezinski on his knowledge of foreign policy. He is knowledgeable, no question about it. Overly knowledgeable. I can remember, it seemed to me that every time a new problem arose that we had not discussed before, he always had a multi-point answer, you know, 8 points, 6 points. It was as though he considered and deliberated over it for a length of time, and then he produced the findings to us, you know, oral papers. A great facility for that. He's not a man at a loss for words. And if he is as persuasive in the Polish language, which I do not speak, as he is in the English language, then he would be a formidable man to come to grips with foreign policy. No, I think that whatever problems he had with Vance, and I'll let each of them speak to that, rather than presume to do it myself, they certainly were at odds over the desert rescue operation. That was a Brzezinski initiative, and it was something that Vance opposed. But I think that, except in some annoying ways, he concluded that, number one, that President Carter couldn't afford to lose a second Secretary of State. Number two, that this was a presidential election year, and that I had, having been a national candidate myself, a national constituency, that it was of value to the president, and that it wasn't for him to rock the boat. And so, on a personal basis, our relationship was congenial. Oh, we got into some hot arguments, you know. How could you expect two poles?
Can you enumerate what some of those policies?
Well, the policies?
He suggests you were much softer towards the Russians than he was. He mentioned in September about a warning to the Soviets in September of 1980.
I think we were in agreement on that. I mean, the Poles or the Russians. This followed. We went through several exercises in the National Security Council meetings. We had frequent meetings, average once a week, I think. We went through several exercises that were very much like the one that we did for Ted Koppel's show. You remember that one? A crisis exercise we did. It was on the same subject. The Soviets were mobilizing, deploying troops along the Iranian border and also along the Polish border at the same time. And so we went through exercises to try to interpret what those suggested and what our response would be as we hypothesized, you know, developments along that line. What could they have in mind? What might they have in mind? What ideas might they have in mind? If there was a threat there, what were we in a position to do? What forces were in a position to deploy? Now, as I remember those discussions, since they were hypothetical situations, by and large, until the event, we were doing this exercise to prepare for the event, I can't recall any discussion that separated the hawks from the doves. But I don't think he found me dovish in arguments with him. And I certainly didn't find him dovish. I don't know what he means.
I'll show you the page.
Well, the point of reading is just...
We'll have a chance. Another non-Polish question. Question from the outer group.
Yeah, I was in regards to the Palestinian autonomy talks, the second part of the Camp David Accords, how much input did you have with the negotiations during your 8 months as Secretary of State? Was that solely in the realm of Ambassador Linowitz's position?
Well, he, of course, was on the spot negotiator, Saul Linowitz, an excellent one. Incidentally, he's also a Cornell graduate. He was an upperclassman. I remind him that he was an upperclassman and older than I was, 1 year. But no, he was doing an excellent job and, of course, kept us fully informed. But there were several developments that occurred that had the effect of interrupting the Camp David peace process. I remember one that my memory's refreshed because I saw this member of the Knesset on television this morning, Geula Cohen, G-E-U-L-A. She introduced a motion to formally establish Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. That did not have the support of the Israeli government. Their description of their reaction to it was that it was a mischievous thing. But once it appeared on the floor of the Knesset, it was very difficult to defeat it, for any Israeli member of the Knesset to go on record as opposed to that. Well, I think they were able to defeat that one. But then there were other developments in the United Nations which required a response. And on one occasion, I confess, I'm sorry, I forget what it was, but we abstained from voting on it when the Israelis wanted us to vote against it, as usual. Some of those resolutions in the Security Council were very ingeniously put together in order to make it difficult for us to present the motion as one-sided against Israel, as irrational. And so by and large, we tried to give support, but then the Israeli government would take actions that President Sadat took issue with, and I think at least twice while I was secretary, he interrupted the peace process because of actions taken, I don't know how you pronounce her name, G-E-U-L-A, Cohen matter. He interrupted the peace process because of that action. And I think there was one other. So we were involved in this sense. When the negotiations were on, then Linowitz was in charge. But when the negotiations were interrupted, then we had to get involved to try to, to resolve the interruption, the reason for the interruption, and resume the negotiations. So the result was, we didn't really make very much progress. And in the negotiations themselves, as Linowitz said, you ever had Linowitz down here to discuss this?
Yes, in fact, he's an associate in this.
So he's probably giving you this background from his own personal recollection, which is more valuable than my attempt to recall what he told us. But there's always difficulty when you've got to such issues as, you know, partial autonomy for the Palestinians. And another very explosive issue is the resettlement of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip by Israeli settlements, which I think we all regarded as stirring the pot unnecessarily. And now, of course, after all these years, those resettlements are part of the enormous difficulty now of arranging for any Palestinian autonomy on the West Bank or in Gaza. So the problem has not been eased by the resettlement policy, and the Israeli governments have never interrupted those resettlement policies. And in the Camp David Accords, that kind of subject was implicitly left to the negotiation process. But the policy was established by unilateral Israeli policy for reasons that are understandable, but which make agreement very, very difficult. But at least during that process and until President Sadat's death after we left office, the peace process was regarded as valuable, as something that needed to be kept alive and that had to be kept going. It took enormous patience on both sides and on our part to do so. Now, I guess I would have to say that peace process, time has run out on it anyway, and it's a historical fact now rather than a current policy possibility. I haven't said this publicly and wouldn't because I don't want to discourage any conceivable possibility of picking it up again. So it's going to have to be replaced by something else, I think.
What's the number?
Mr. Muskie, in your illustrious career, you've rendered distinguished service in the legislative branch in the Senate and also in the administration. Recently, there has been considerable public discussion because of events in the news media having to do with the participation of members of the legislative branch in foreign affairs in one way or another. Without asking you to comment on the personalities involved, unless you care to do so, would you comment on the principles involved in connection with the implementation of the constitutional intent, whatever that is?
I suppose you're talking about Jim Wright. Well, the fact is, Ken and I both worked on a publication. I saw two copies on your desk.
President Congress
and National Security, which I think is an excellent discussion of that subject. I was co-chairman of that project. Ken Rush was the other co-chairman. And we had the assistance, I think, of roughly 40 to 50 distinguished Americans to discuss the subject. And Ken was rapporteur of the project. And I thought it came out with a good report that I still use from time to time to discuss this subject. There's no question but what this is an area which the Constitution, in my view, established as a shared responsibility. And there's a cyclical response to that constitutional arrangement. I think we said in the book that the constitutional arrangement was an invitation to struggle between the President and the Congress. The President, of course, not by any explicit requirement of the Constitution, but by virtue of being the Chief Executive Officer, of course, is the principal representative of the United States in dealing with foreign governments. There's no other way for that to be done. And because of that advantage which he has, he's able to conduct discussions with foreign governments, representatives of foreign governments, negotiations, and he's carried that to the point in the history of the Republic of even subduing the treaty-making power and replacing it with executive agreements that didn't need to be confirmed by the Senate. So the President, over the 200 years of our country, has expanded his role, or the perception of his role that I think probably was dominant at the time of the Constitutional Convention. So that there is a resistance on the part of the President, any proper resistance, I think, to that kind of role being played by representatives of the congressional branch or anyone else. And yet it's interesting that the first negotiator picked by President Washington to negotiate an important treaty was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. And Washington, no one surely was more familiar with the doctrine of separation of powers than President Washington was. He presided over the Constitutional Convention, after all. But yet he reached into the Supreme Court to pick the negotiator of that treaty, and that also precipitated an issue as between the President and the Congress, because the President, considering the Jay Treaty, which undertook to clean up some of the unresolved issues left by the Treaty of Paris following the Revolutionary War, that negotiation hadn't met with President Washington's approval altogether, but the Senate requested the confidential record of those negotiations. Again, we have a modern counterpart to that today. And the President shared those secret instructions and private negotiations, secret negotiations with the Senate. And the Senate acted on the treaty, and it was subsequently to that that the House asked for that secret information. And the President turned them down. He said, we can share in areas where there is a constitutional area for the House to act, such as impeachment, for example. But beyond that, the Senate and the President under the Constitution share the foreign policy powers. I've fulfilled that, and that's sufficient. So the President made clear a very sensitive and selective approach to this problem. Now, is it proper? Let's take Jim Wright's situation head on. Now, it is a fact that today, unlike earlier periods, you know, foreign governments now deal directly with the members of the Congress, because members of the Congress handle legislation of importance to them. I know the Canadian ambassador there, you know, has contacts on the Hill that he nurses and flourishes. And there is a trade agreement pending for the Senate's consideration. So what do you expect? And so as foreign governments, and you see the Central American leaders come up to Washington, and they're sent to the Hill by the President. They go on their own volition. They're invited, I'm sure, by members of the Congress, particularly the Senate, to come up to the Hill to discuss their problems. And so that kind of contact is ongoing. And from time to time, a member of Congress, like Jim Wright, who is under pressure to establish his leadership position, particularly in an area where the President and the Congress are sharply divided, aid to the Congress. I mean, it's inevitable that he should undertake to accept its leadership responsibility from Congress's point of view to influence that policy in a direction which is consistent with congressional wishes. I don't think there's any prohibition against it, except one's own views about the proper role of each. The Logan Act doesn't even successfully inhibit private citizens from conducting talks with foreign governments. Jesse Jackson's been doing it all over the map. And nobody's raised the Logan Act as a possible sanction against that sort of thing. And of course, members of Congress travel all over the map. They're expressing foreign policy views, which are not necessarily the equivalent of negotiations. And I think by this time, foreign governments are sufficiently attuned to the disarray of the American policymaking system that they accept it and understand it and suffer through it. But public opinion can impose restraints, and I suspect that even Jim Wright has felt some public pressure to be a little more private, so to say.
I didn't mean to restrict my inquiry to Representative Wright, because there are a number of other examples. You have the Kennedys in Ireland, you have others in India,
no, I understand
you have other
that.
Parts of the world.
I picked one only because yes. It was a little easier to comment on one than other Kennedys.
And it happens to be known right at the moment.
No, you're absolutely right. It does happen. And in my case, President Carter sent me to Europe to talk to Schmidt about the important issues between us, the new missiles that Schmidt had been largely responsible for, getting us to develop. And Portugal, we had problems. We had base problems in Portugal. We had. I had to meet with the Spanish king to talk about the looming space base problems that we had there. Went to Berlin to talk about the West Germans' East policy. So all of these things involved not that we negotiated any agreements, but certainly discussions of the purpose of one, serving the needs of Congress, and two, serving the needs of the president, our little girls. So it happens, and I think we've got to be accustomed to that. What really bothers me about the Congress is its inclination to attach to legislation, conditions that they seek to impose on the State Department or the President that I think are out of place. There were, I think, 87 amendments to the State Department Appropriation Bill last year that involved intervention by the Congress in a whole range of annoying examples of congressional interventions, and that happens, and that's attributable, I think, to a different cause.
Would you worry a little bit more about the transition period when Mr. Allen, for instance, traveled, told us at a meeting we had here, traveled throughout Europe and met with foreign leaders prior to inauguration? Is that a troublesome part of this greater involvement of parties other than those with constitutional authority?
Well, I think there's a good answer and a bad answer. I mean, obviously, new administration needs to position itself with our allies and with the Congress and with the American public on these policy initiatives. The problem really that troubles me about transition periods is that there's a disposition on new presidents, whether they are the same administration as the successor or a different political party, to disown current policy and to seek to appear to establish their own new policies. I remember one example of that. And that was the Saudi Arabians' request to purchase the AWACS planes. Now, in connection with the Iran-Iraq war, we had the proof. The assignment of AWACS planes, in effect on loan to the Saudi Arabians, as a protection against possible Iranian aggression across the Gulf. Well, then toward the end of our watch, the Saudis asked to purchase well, there's been an ongoing problem over several years now of providing arms, you know, the F-15 aircraft, for example, other arms to the Saudis. And the objection comes from Israel that these weapons could be used against Israel. And so Congress had established constraints within which we had to operate. Congress had to be informed, and I think there was a waiting period of some 60 days before any agreements of that kind could be implemented, to give Congress time to come in. And so they asked us if we would agree, if we would sell them the Iraq planes that they were already having the benefit of. Well, we concluded that we didn't have time. I mean, our time was pretty well run out. We couldn't, 60 days couldn't work. We indicated our support for the idea and said that we would undertake to discuss the matter with the incoming administration, which we did. The president did with Mr. Reagan, and I did with Mr. Haig. And we offered to go to the Hill with them while we were still in office, to recommend with them that that was their disposition, you know, to agree to the sale or to recommend the sale. Well, they did not want to do that. They wanted to separate themselves from us on that issue. So they waited, I think, 8 or 10 months before they initiated that proposal themselves, and had a very difficult task with it. Finally succeeded, finally got congressional approval, but I think they could have gotten it without any difficulty at all 8 months earlier, and avoided, you know, public controversy that emerged when they finally did go. Well, there's no harm done in all of this, but the point I'm making is still valid. Now, the inclination, in the case of the Reagan administration, a very strong inclination, to simply separate themselves from our ongoing policy to the extent that they could and start afresh. And this has a relevance, incidentally, to the Tower Board studies. Maybe we'll get into this noon, if not later this morning. So that if, you know, people like Alan are traveling around, you know, you've got to grant an incoming president, you know, the option of doing that. I would hope that someone in that position would not undertake to do so in a way that would frustrate an ongoing policy of the United States because it was being conducted by, you know, the outgoing administration. It's always a risk. It involves, you know, a very sensitive approach to all of this. Other than that, I mean, the historic one from my point of view was the refusal of President-elect Roosevelt to meet with President Hoover in advance of his taking office in March of 1933 on the economy of the country. And Roosevelt simply would have nothing to do with it. He simply refused. Whether that would have made a difference, I'd say, but he was willing to take full responsibility for his administration, but he wanted to have also the responsibility of putting his policy in place and not rely in part or in whole upon the Hoover administration to do it. So these presidents have to do, you know, what they want to do. I don't know of any way that you can, I don't think you can institutionalize a change in that practice. I don't think you can put in place a set of prohibitions or guidelines that the incoming presidents will honor. They're going to do it their way. That's what they're elected to do. And there isn't much you can do about it.
One last question.
During the last few days, we've been seeing in the newspapers references to Mr. Poindexter's diaries, and I believe the commission, the Tower Commission, was not given access to those diaries. Do you believe this would have made a difference to you?
Well, it would have been helpful. You see, we had no subpoena powers. Our authority for getting information was the president's directive, which was very clear and was contained in the Tower Board report. And honored, as far as we knew, by all agencies, all relevant agencies of the government. And we were very satisfied with that. That did not make available to us, of course, the testimony or records of individuals who chose to take the Fifth Amendment. The president was in no position to overcome their constitutional rights in that respect. And so we did not hear, we did not take testimony from Oliver North, John Poindexter, or Richard Secord, or Mr. Hakeem, or Fawn Hawk. There's five very obviously. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that written records that still in possession of the government weren't available to us. But the fact is that the most difficult period for us to get the facts was the period of August and September of 1985. It is in that period that the first decisions to approve Israeli transfer of weapons to Iran were made. And there were no formal records that we could discover. And the principals had differing recollections of what had happened and when. Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, who were statutory members of the council, did not agree in their recollections of what happened and what decisions were taken and who was present in August of 85. The Chief of Staff's recollection did not match that of those two gentlemen. The president's recollection was uncertain at best. He recollected approving, but the time when he approved was of significance, and there his memory was weak. McFarland's record was the most comprehensive and the most detailed, but it wasn't reinforced by anybody else's recollection. So there we were. It's obvious that because of, it seems obvious, that because of their preoccupation with the importance of maintaining the secrecy of the operation, that they have as little written record as possible. I find that hard to accept, but that at least was the way we saw it when we were through, because the written records for August. Now, McFarland told us that Poindexter was appointed as the note-taker at meetings of the Security Council in that period. This was before McFarland resigned in the last of November. And yet we could find nothing in the thousands of documents that were turned over to us, any evidence of any notes that Poindexter took. Now, whether he actually took notes, this latest story is the only information we have, and I haven't read that story, so I don't know what there is. And I'm anxious to get back to discuss the matter with our general counsel at the time, Clark McFadden. So if there were notes, then that confirms, in my judgment, McFarland's testimony to us that Poindexter was indeed the note taker, and that there should have been notes available. If he had taken notes and they weren't available, then presumably somebody destroyed them. And of course we have some record of destruction of records. So it's a very interesting sidelight in the whole thing. I don't know that if we'd had those notes, well, we would have known earlier, I suppose. Well, unless we know what are in the notes that have now been discovered, I can't really judge. If in those notes, if there were notes in addition to whatever notes he took at Security Council meetings, that is personal notes, similar to some notes that Ollie North took, keeping a record of his own involvement. If there had been such notes, it may be that we would have learned earlier that he had not informed the president of the diversion of funds, for example, as he testified. So I'd be interested in knowing what those notes were. They could have made a difference. I tell you, the notes I would like for somebody to discover are whatever notes Bill Casey had. To me, there's the big gap in the whole story, really. And we'll never know unless we have a messenger to the hereafter to bring back his story.
Maybe the most treasured judgment anybody can have is the judgment of his peers, particularly peers with whom you work hour after hour on difficult issues. This last question reminds us that when we mentioned we hope to have Secretary Muskie visit the Miller Center, one of his colleagues on the tower board said, you must do all you can to bring that about. He said, Secretary Muskie is a great man. That kind of a judgment, I think, is repeated by others who have worked closely with him. The evidence is pretty clear in the discussion we've had today. We're pleased all of you came, but we're most of all pleased that we hope we've had the first of several exchanges. Perhaps the next one could be on the Tower Board report with Secretary Muskie. Thank you so much.